The following program features the opinions of the host. Listeners are encouraged to seek their own understanding.
The Tower of Babel was built after Noah's great flood. Yahweh had told Noah and his sons to go out and multiply on the earth, and they did have children and multiply, but they disobeyed when it came to dispersing. They stayed in one area and shared one language, and they decided to build themselves a city with a great tower to the heavens. What exactly was this tower? And why did Yahweh decide to spread many languages and confuse their efforts? What were these men creating? Clearly, this stone tower didn't rise to the heights of our modern-day skyscrapers. And who exactly was Nimrod, who seems to have led these efforts? Did the men of Babel create a portal for the gods to come through? Welcome to the Ghost in You podcast, a podcast about the weird, the wonderful, and the terrifying in the Bible. I'm Diane Student, your guide and host on this strange journey through the Bible. Episode 11, The Tower of Babel. Ham had a son named Cush, and he had a son named Nimrod. Genesis 10, verses 8 to 12 says, Cush fathered Nimrod. He was the first on earth to be a mighty man. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calne in the land of Shinar. From that land he went into Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth-ur, Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, that is the great city. There are several reasons that Nimrod is unique in this chapter of the Bible. The different children of Noah's sons are all named, and we are told they become their own clans. But none of the individuals are separated out and given descriptive verses, like Nimrod. On top of that, we are told that he has a kingdom, and it seems quite vast, encompassing several cities. The Hebrew word used here is Gabor, which means strong or mighty. Nimrod was a mighty hunter, and the first on earth to be a mighty man. The Nephilim were called the mighty men of old. So how is it that Nimrod was the first? Some translations have this as that he began to be a mighty man on the earth. That makes it tough to figure out if he was a Nephilim or just a great human. There are some scholars and Bible teachers who believe that somehow Nimrod became something like a Nephilim, or even perhaps that he was inhabited by Satan himself. Nimrod's name means let's rebel or the rebel, so he more than likely wasn't given this name at birth. And he may not have even had that name, but rather it was used as a descriptive word of him. Nimrod's Akkadian and Sumerian name was Ninurta, which means Lord of the Earth. And Ninurta was a hero god of war, hunting, and the south wind. Some believe that Nimrod was actually also Gilgamesh and Hercules. Legends claim that Ninurta was the son of Enlil, and Enlil more than likely was just another name for Satan. So how could Nimrod, whose father was Cush, be the son of Enlil? I'm thinking the word son here may not mean biological. We can get some other clues into what type of person Nimrod was by looking at the Epic of Gilgamesh. In this tale, Gilgamesh goes after the god that sent the flood, who is named Yahweh, which if you ask me is pretty similar to Yahweh. He kills Yahweh and is thought to be the mighty vanquisher of Yahweh. More accurate translations of the section in Genesis 10 about Nimrod read, Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a tyrant in the earth. He was a tyrannical hunter in opposition of the Lord. Thus it is said, Nimrod the tyrannical opponent of Yahweh. So he was not a mighty hunter before the Lord, but more probably the mighty hunter of the Lord. But as we know, Yahweh is not dead. The key takeaway when it comes to Nimrod is that although he is only given a few lines in the Bible, he was an important historical figure, and even possibly a type of Antichrist. There are those who believe that Nimrod will rise again as the Antichrist. That makes it very interesting that America went into Iraq in 2003 to find weapons of mass destruction that didn't actually exist. What we did find and loot were over 17,000 artifacts, one of which was a clay tablet with the Epic of Gilgamesh on it. A news report in August 2021 claims that we are getting ready to return all those artifacts. Is it possible that we went there to find the tomb of Gilgamesh? Is there a mummy of Gilgamesh with genetic material that could be used to clone this ancient Antichrist? It was reported in April of 2003 that the tomb had been located. Genesis 11 verses 1 to 9 recounts the narrative of the Tower of Babel. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord dispersed them from there, over the face of the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. Nimrod is credited with leading the building of the Tower of Babel. He established the city here, and clearly this is a one-world type of government, because we are told this was one people with one language. Nimrod ruled them with tyranny. His goal was to make the people dependent on him rather than God. Yahweh felt that this oneness made these people powerful, particularly Nimrod, and that eventually nothing would be impossible for them. Hence why God felt he needed to confuse the languages and disperse the people. This was over all the earth, so this quite possibly could be when North America and South America become inhabited. Now, what exactly was this tower? Clearly, there's no way that humans could build a tower so tall that it reached into the heavens. So there must have been another purpose, another way to reach the gods. Perhaps a portal. The actual tower was built from stone and was a ziggurat. A ziggurat is a rectangular stepped pyramid, or tower that usually had a temple on the top, and these were built in ancient Mesopotamia. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm thinking if you want to build a tower to the heavens, you would start on a mountaintop, not in a plain in the land of Shinar, as the Bible tells us. We aren't given a description of the tower and have no pictures in stone. We have to base our assumptions about what the tower looked like on other ziggurats in the region. King Nebuchadnezzar II reigned from 604 to 562 BC, and he rebuilt the city of Babylon, which would become an empire. This included the construction of the city walls, palaces, and temples to gods like Marduk. He also rebuilt the Tower of Babel. Greek historian Herodotus visited Babylon and wrote of visiting the tower in 440 BC. In the middle of the precinct, there was a tower of solid masonry, a furlong, which is 201 meters in length and breadth, upon which was raised a second tower, and on that a third, and so on up to eight. The ascent to the top is on the outside by a path which winds around all the towers. When one is about halfway up, one finds a resting place and seats, where persons can sit for some time on their way to the summit. On the topmost tower there is a spacious temple, and inside the temple stands a couch of unusual size. I just want to pause there. Unusual size? Perhaps something big enough for Nephilim? Richly adorned with a golden table by its side. There is no statue of any kind set up in the place, nor is the chamber occupied of nights by anyone but a single native woman, who, as the Chaldeans, the priests of this god, affirm, is chosen for himself by the deity out of all the women of the land. So that gives us a really good picture. This indeed wasn't built all the way to the heavens, but it was a pretty massive structure. A businessman from Norway named Martin Skoyen collected over 13,000 artifacts into a private collection. Within this collection was a black stone upon which was carved an image of the tower and King Nebuchadnezzar that dated to between 604 and 562 BC. This has been dubbed the Tower of Babel Steel. To be sure, this is not the original tower based on dates, but rather a temple called Etemenanki, which was to honor Marduk. This rose 7 stories and 300 feet high. This was a step pyramid with a temple on top, and the inscription even reveals the inner arrangement of rooms. The key takeaway is that this was a grand structure, but certainly not something that reached into the heavens. Something else had to reach into another dimension. Aleister Crowley was perhaps one of the most evil men to ever live. He certainly claimed to be. He was an occultist, writer, artist, magician, and founder of the religion of Thelema. He proclaimed that he would lead us into the Aeon of Horus. Crowley performed many rituals, including sex magic, which is a very powerful form of magic. Think of it this way. Procreation is the closest we get to being God. Procreation creates life. Crowley and his followers thought that the point of conception was very powerful and that there was a way to invoke evil spirits through this. In 1919, Crowley performed a series of rituals called the Amalantra Workings. Through this, he was able to open a portal. Something so terrifying happened that Crowley sealed back up this portal. Fast forward to 1946, and a man named Jack Parsons. He was a rocket scientist and a good friend of Ron Hubbard, the man who founded Scientology. Both of these men were occultists too, and big fans of Crowley. They performed a same series of rituals called, interestingly, the Babylon Working, out in the Mojave Desert. This was meant to reopen Crowley's portal, and it did that, but on a bigger scale. A scale that reputedly was impossible to close again. I mention these stories as evidence that portals can be opened to reach the other side. The people of Nimrod and Shinar must have been getting close to success, since Yahweh felt that he needed to come down, confuse the languages, and disperse everyone in different directions. Gary Stearman is the host of Prophecy Watchers, and he says that more than likely the people building the tower were looking to, quote, realize their darkest imaginings. And what had they imagined to do? Simply to renew their contact with the sons of God, as their predecessors had done before the flood. Mark Flynn wrote Forbidden Secrets of the Labyrinth in 2014, and in it he writes, "The tower was not necessarily a device that would cause men to become gods immediately, but an interdimensional conduit that would once more bring the assistance of the Watchers, who would make men gods like themselves through the knowledge they provided." If you recall, 1 Enoch 8 relates that the Watchers shared forbidden knowledge with humans. The story of the Tower of Babel is not that far removed from the Great Flood. How quickly these people fell right back into a way of life that was in rebellion to God. That is because we are in a spiritual battle, and always have been, and will be until the end comes. There is no physical evidence that this tower ever existed, and we may never know exactly who Nimrod was in history. Was he just a legend, or a real man, or even a demigod? Did he commission the building of a great tower? Did he try to open a portal to allow the fallen angels and demonic spirits of the Nephilim, or what we would commonly call the Rephaim, to come through? The ghost in you knows. Thanks so much for joining me on this episode. If you'd like to send me some comments, you can do that at theghostinyoupod@gmail.com. And please follow us at Instagram, YouTube, and BitChute. May God bless you and keep you. The Ghost in You podcast is researched, written, edited, and produced by me, Diane Student. Our theme music is by Muse Music with Groove Studios. All of the music is by artists from filmmusic.io.